Welcome to The Offer, the no sugar added approach to the talent triangle with an unfiltered view of employers, candidates, and recruiters. I am your host, Michael Glinter.
The Offer, unfiltered.
Before we get started, just a reminder, if you need any type of services, questions, you are looking to do a sponsorship on my show, or you have needs as far as resumes or anything as far as the staffing industry, please email me at michael@michaelglinter.com. Again, that is michael@michaelglinter.com, so we can connect. You can also check me out on social media. And please, as a reminder, don't forget, you can subscribe to this podcast to get weekly updates, as well as please pass along information to your friends and family. Today's guest, I don't even know how to introduce her. I've known Monique for going on 15 years. Her and I became contacts back in 2005. She is an absolutely amazing person. She has passion, excitement. She drives the culture of diversity and inclusion at her company. And be honest with you, I consider her a friend because her and I speak from the same language, the same cloth, and we have the same mindsets. And so I'm excited for you to listen to her and I talk today because I really feel like she brings a perspective to what companies can do to better drive these programs and a perspective that we have not talked about on the show. So without better introduction, here is Monique.
Well, how are you?
Good. It's been a crazy week already. So I'm super excited. I can't even tell you how excited I am to talk to you.
Good, me too.
I've been, since January, I've been doing this series on my podcast. It's really just taking off. And it's been interesting because I've met so many amazing people. But the series started with, you know, bringing attention and light to diversity inclusion programs. And it kind of propelled into talking to all different types of people from all walks of life and hearing their stories and hearing, you know, the things that are happening to them and really what can we do to drive change. And, you know, several promises I've made to several of the people that I interviewed was that I was going to, you know, engage companies and talk to and educate, you know, other companies on what other companies are doing right, and what they need to do to inherently, you know, bring that change. And, you know, given the fact that I've worked with PepsiCo for years, I know the culture, I know the people, I've been to a lot of the locations. I was excited when, you know, I got the opportunity to engage you because I know that PepsiCo and Frito-Lay has really been a forefront to a lot of different diversity and inclusion initiatives. And yeah. I really want to hear your side of, you know, what you guys do to drive that, because, you know, it's, you know, a lot of companies, you know, they say they do it, but they don't. We know they don't. They even put people in roles, D&I roles, and say that now they're D&I people and they're not. So I guess, you know, you've been with the company for almost, what, 16 or 17 years now?
15 years.
Yeah. You know, obviously it's been a journey. Obviously throughout your journey with them, you've molded into the different positions. Now you're in this D&I role. What do you think that PepsiCo has done to really drive this program successfully?
You know, when I think about diversity and inclusion and engagement and equity and belonging, what I find that we do really well is that we really consider the strong legacy that has led the diversity practices and really have done a beautiful job reinventing ourselves to remain relevant, but relevant in the space of always knowing that diversity is a business priority. It's not a nice to do. It's not in fashion to do. It's something that you do because it is a business priority. And if we consider it an important business priority, this in the same regard that we think about how we want to be profitable and we want to grow market share, that if it is truly this priority that we put our resources behind and the right people in place, that it will enable us to really remain relevant and competitive. And we consider that in every aspect of how we work against diversity, inclusion, engagement, both at the macro PepsiCo level and then of course across all of the divisions of PepsiCo.
Now, you guys, from what I've heard, and I'm kind of secondhand, the types of things that you guys do, when a person comes to work for PepsiCo, what are some of the trainings or some of the groups or things that they get engaged with right off the bat to know that they're going into an organization that, you know, drives this initiative and being a part of that initiative? Because, you know, a lot of times I hear people saying, you know, when I get to a company, I don't know, you know, they don't get asked to participate. They don't get how do you get people to be engaged? Right. You're like, I asked one of my clients, like, can you require them to attend classes? You know, and she's like, well, no, we can't really do that. I'm like, well, there's got to be a secret sauce to it because you guys get people engaged. So what do you guys do?
I would say before an individual even joins our organization, we're very explicit about diversity and engagement and inclusion being a business priority and how it is amplified and how it manifests in our organization. So when you join PepsiCo as a part of your onboarding process as a leader, whether you're a people leader, an individual contributor, whatever the level you join this organization, you will go through diversity and inclusion training as a part of your onboarding. And that includes being provided awareness about how we activate diversity, inclusion, and engagement. If you are a people leader, you will go through very specific training that's going to take you through different tools and techniques around diversity. What is diversity? You know, diversity is who we are. What is inclusion? Inclusion is how we behave. What is belonging? You know, what is engagement? We really talk about those details. And in addition to taking you through the training, as a people leader, you are also educated about the non-negotiables in terms of our values and policies that we expect of all leaders. So it's setting that foundation that includes diversity and inclusion. It includes engagement and really tells you what we stand for by way of the 7 PepsiCo behaviors. And quite honestly, also sharing with you what we don't stand for and what's not tolerated. And we help people to become familiar with the diversity and engagement imperatives, the priorities. We take you through actual training to learn tools and techniques, whether it's around intention and impact, bias, the different types of biases that exist, but we're also sharing with you what our values and purpose are to understand how we expect you to behave, not how we want you to change, how we expect you to behave as a member of this organization.
One of the big hot buttons that I've been tackling recently is transgender people. How do you address though, like, if somebody is 1,000% in, they support the initiative, they go through this training, do you guys teach your employees what's appropriate, how to act, if they're feeling uncomfortable or something puts them in a position that they don't feel right and they're not being discriminatory, but everybody has to feel comfortable in their workspace. What kind of things do you guys provide so that you can help people be comfortable? So, to make a more blunt statement, if somebody just doesn't feel comfortable around a transgender person, they don't know, who knows why, they just don't feel comfortable. Obviously, they don't want to do anything or say anything that may seem that way, but how do you teach them without forcing them to feel comfortable or forcing them to agree on the beliefs of it to be comfortable with the situation of being in that moment?
Again, for us, it goes back to what do you share in terms of creating the landscape of what is and is not considered acceptable behavior that we tolerate. So I think that's extremely important to share with people, not how I want to change you, how I want to make you think how I think. I want you to know that when you join PepsiCo, you recognize that we support diversity and engagement, and it's not only the right thing to do, it's the right thing to do for our business. So if you want to be a part of this business, you have to know that we are deeply committed to understanding the values and our guiding philosophies, which is in order for us to win and be purposeful, right? Because you could win a whole host of ways, but if you want to win and be purposeful, and there will be people who are not like you, they don't think like you, they don't look like you, they don't have similar background like you, et cetera. I want you to recognize that in our company, we acknowledge and believe that the strongest way for us to be our best is when our company embraces that full spectrum of humanity. So we want to educate you on what the full spectrum of humanity will look like. It could be diversity of thought, gender, ethnicity, race, religion. It goes on to really talk. I think you have to talk about it, and that's important for us. We talk about it. We educate you. We set the, you know, I would say that you set the stage for what you expect so that people engage in their everyday work and with different people who are different identities, that you understand what is and is not acceptable. Now, of course, if you are not feeling comfortable, I think it's important to know that in building a diverse culture that is more inclusive in the workplace, we promote what we call courageous engagement. So we really work very hard to train our managers on having courageous conversations, making sure their teams understand that there will be differences that we face. What makes us better and makes us great is how we engage those different communities of people who make up the organization. So it's not a perfect science, but it really involves communicating what you stand for and being very clear about the values and philosophy of the company.
So you said something, I love it. You made this comment about this engagement, this being able to speak to one another. I forget the actual term just now, but
courageous engagement.
Courageous engagement, yeah. Sorry about that. Is approaching somebody to talk to them about having a better understanding of them, isn't that a little bit intrusive? I guess my thought process is, you know, I mean, I'm gay. Do I care if somebody comes up to me and asks me about it? No. I mean, I could care less, but not everybody's going to be like that. And mind you, is it appropriate, right? I mean, is it really even appropriate in the workplace? But we know those situations come up. When you say that this courageous engagement, how do you know that's welcome?
So I think for our organization or an organization who's going to embark on this journey well, you have to also recognize, too, what are the foundational elements that you need to share with your team. So you have to really set clear priorities. So from a global diversity and engagement perspective at PepsiCo, we really educate around the imperatives of the what, and then we talk through the priorities of the how. So people understand when we discuss diversity and engagement, it's around representation, courageous engagement, and how we invest in the community. And specifically from a courageous engagement perspective, we will take our people leaders through how to have a courageous conversation to engage your teams, realizing there may be topics or circumstances that you're not comfortable with. Our role is to help you to meet people at their center and be able to just discuss respectfully the values and philosophy that make us the organization that we are. So it's a lot of training, and you have to be very clear, again, what is it that you stand for and what are your expectations?
I love the fact that you guys have these training mechanisms right at the beginning. Like, yes. You know, you don't wait for a tinder in the fire. You don't wait for a situation. You throw people feet first right in and say, okay, we're going to learn about this.
Absolutely.
I don't know of a time yet that I've talked to any company that literally it's part of your onboarding. Which I think is amazing. Do you get pushback ever? Do you ever get a situation or moments where people feel that it's almost putting it too much in their face?
Yes, but much like anything, you know, that might be different or new for any person or any leader, any individual, right? Regardless of what the title is, because I always say, you know, you rent your title, but you own your character. It's important to be able to share with the people who join the organization what makes the fabric of who we are. So what I mean by that is we are very clear about the commitments that we make as an organization, the commitment in the area of diversity and engagement, within diversity and engagement, the commitment that we've made for women, and then most recently, the commitment that we made from a racial equality perspective. I think it's extremely important that from the top, the leaders have to be very clear about the commitments that they want to drive in any organization. I'll take women for example. It's extremely important to understand what your leader stands for. So why advance women? Why is women's empowerment important? Well, it's a business priority and we have to focus on it and recognize we have barriers. You have to talk about it. You have to share and be very explicit what those priorities are and also explain the why. And in addition to that, it's important for us to also have clear goals to think through what is the consistent measurement when we establish these goals. Then you have to track it and share that progress, reward people, of course, and then ultimately be accountable to what you've shared and hold your teams accountable. And I think through those different phases, and they don't happen all at once, I would say, you know, I think of it in horizons, you have to really be established, but very clear from the leader on the leader who is at the top, in order for people to know this company is serious about what they're committed to.
I'm going to flip the script a little bit. Mm-hmm. Lately, I've been engaging with people on the thought process of equity, you know, being able to grow within an org. So you have the diversity piece, you have the inclusive piece, but you know, what's more important is the people at the top. Is the leadership that's being developed equal across the board? Are you seeing the diverse nature in leadership? And, you know, we can all admit that over the last couple decades now, you know, it's not been equal. And we've seen a lot of, you know, very white, Caucasian, male, female, you know, boards and upper management. That's slowly changing, but it's not nearly where it needs to be. What do you feel like it's just the companies that are keeping or holding people back? Because I to a degree feel like sometimes diversity, people of diversity, you know, just because of where they grow up or how they're you're taught, they don't feel compelled to take that extra mile. And how do we get them to do that? Like, how do we get people of diversity to want to be the director, VP, the president?
So I would say it's multi-pronged. So the first, and it goes back to, you know, what you inspect is what you expect. And what I mean by that is right now we're on a journey of providing more training and education to our leaders in the area of unconscious bias. It's huge. Everyone's talking about different types of bias. What do we need to do? Is it implicit bias? Is it bias in the hiring and promotion process and so forth? I think it's important to level set your team and your leaders at a company in a shared and common language. And again, go back to expectations. So when I think about our leadership and how we can ensure that the landscape of leadership begins to shift and become more equitable, we have to first talk about the current state. So in our organization, going back to 2016, when the commitment for women was made, we had to first come out internally to ourselves and say, do we feel good about what we see? Or do we recognize that a cultural shift is necessary if we want to have a more equitable environment for women at PepsiCo? And equitable for us is the journey towards gender parity, which is we believe that we can commit to having at least 50% female managers at PepsiCo by 2025 across the organization.
Wow.
That to me is what is important, is that you have to first acknowledge your current state. Look at the data. The data will not lie. And in some instances, you've got to disaggregate the data. Once you start to look at the data, even at the gender level, we have to then look at it from an ethnicity perspective and really fit in what those numbers tell us. And equally as important is then seeing, well, what are the leading and lagging indicators that's driving it? You know, it is not a one-stop fix all process. It's not a peanut butter approach. So for us, it was being able to look at our numbers, have our senior leader, and at that time, our CEO, who said, gender parity is a business priority, and we need to commit to getting there. Let's look at our numbers and see where we are at. We put a goal in place, which is 50% female leaders at the management level by 2025. Now we need to go and do the work. So we've acknowledged the problem. We think about the opportunity areas or the gaps to close, whether it's around hiring, promotion, development, retention, sponsorship, support from managers, interaction with senior leaders. Do we have any level of discrimination or microaggressions, allyship? And then also thinking about, as it relates to women in this example, are they the only one? And if all of those are problems to solve, we need to think about actionable steps that need to be taken internally to be able to improve that. And that's the work that we've been doing.
And just for my listeners to know, I mean, the U.S. population is 50% women. The number that you're bringing up shouldn't be a shocker, because at the end of the day, half our country is women.
Absolutely.
I love the fact that you guys have a target, like a target percentage and a target date. Like, this is what we're going to try to accomplish in the next so many years, because a lot of people, they don't. They talk about the fact that they need it, but they don't actually have a goal in mind. Let me ask you this question. So going to that point, do you feel like that there are people that will say there are roles in an organization that oftentimes are female-based, and there's roles in an organization that are oftentimes male? It's, you can call it what you want, but that's, many people will say that. You know, do you, when you guys are thinking about the mix and trying to, you know, bring equality across the board, do you try to encourage, you know, when you have a role in an organization, we'll use a role that I know very well, is, you know, working in fleet maintenance. You know, fleet maintenance tends to be a guy's world, right? Do you guys break it down as much as try to diversify areas that oftentimes are looked at as a male industry or male specialty? Or does that not really matter?
It does matter. Again, it goes back to being very honest with your current state and being very clear about what you want the future goal or outcome to look like. So in the area of fleet or in the area of STEM, where you think about certain functions and certain roles that were traditionally male dominated, if there is an opening and opportunity, we are very clear as a leadership that we have to do a few things well that can help drive the right outcome, which is to get the best talent. And they didn't say female talent or male talent, to get the best talent. But there are absolutely key levers that need to be pulled and recognized, which is, where are you sourcing your talent from? Is it from the same place? Are you being as expansive as possible? And are you being as thorough that are creating more possibilities for candidates who are in the pool of selection to be as diverse as possible, whether it's diverse in terms of thought, geography, race, gender, ethnicity, etc. The second thing that is equally as important is, once your talent acquisition team has done that first level of work, the second phase is to look at the actual applicant pool or candidate slate of individuals, both externally and also internally, and asking ourselves, is this a diverse slate? Do we have 50% women who are being considered for the opportunity? And if the answer is no, you have to make some really tough decisions. And I say tough decision, which is, we need to be patient and at least have an equitable pool of candidates, because that will help us to be more prepared to have a more equitable outcome. I think it requires a level of diligence and patience in having that pool of candidates who are diverse, and then moving it to the next phase, which is, who makes up the hiring team, the interview team? What is the exact process that they're using for the interviews? From the questions to the environment that's being set up, you have to really look at all the different stages that make up hiring talent to ensure that the outcome is equitable for all. And then ultimately the belief is, if we are executing correctly at each stage, it will start to improve the landscape, which is ultimately getting to an area of equity and parity.
What do you guys do? So there's been, so over my journey over the last 6 months, I've expanded my repertoire of understanding of all the different types of people out there that really are discriminated on. And there's areas like people with autism and people that are blind. You know, I had a very interesting conversation with a guy about blind people and how 80% of blind people are unemployed. Like, but if you look at the people that are blind that are employed, their success rates are so high. So I guess my question is what is PepsiCo, or does PepsiCo have any type of special programs that, you know, cater to or look at, you know, some of the untalked about few that just feel like that they're left on the sidelines?
Absolutely. So at PepsiCo, one of our 11 employee resource groups is our Enable employee resource groups with our associates with different abilities, those who are allies of individuals with different abilities. And it's important for us to know that we say two things: the future must be accessible, and the second piece is you belong here. That's the common thread that we bring together, particularly in the space of those with different abilities. And we really have been intentional on saying, how do we ensure that if the future is accessible and we agree to bring them the right employee voice, the right recognition, and then aligning the interests with the values that we have. Specifically in this space, we really leverage the power of the voice of our current employees, specifically leveraging our employee resource groups to not just reflect the company culture, but to help shape it. And then the second area we look at is to align those different interests as it relates to the values and goals of the company. So much like we put goals in place for women, we are pretty critical to look at our different cohort groups, like those with different abilities. So as a part of that process, the first thing you have to do internally, assuming the individual already works at the company, is have a robust self-identification campaign. And that allows us to know what are the different needs associates have to be able to best support them and recognize them so that they can be successful in the organization. I would say the second piece that's equally important is partnering with organizations who are experts in the space. So we are partners with an organization by the name of Disability In, and we recently participated in their annual DEI assessment process, which is a diversity, equity, inclusion assessment process specific to those with different abilities. So it does a thorough analysis on where our company is as it relates to hiring, promotion, infrastructure, accessibility, technology, a whole host of things are evaluated. And through the Disability Equality Index assessment, it helps us to understand our current state, and that's through a third party that's neutral. And it also helps us to know where do we have low-hanging fruit that we could do better to improve the experience of future talent who have different abilities that will join the organization. So that's been extremely important. The second area that we focus on for those with different abilities through partnerships is really in the area of recruitment, because we recognize, to your point, you have so many different individuals who are very talented, but they're just not being given the right opportunity. So we got very deliberate, and this was through a partnership that we have with a company by the name of Disability Solutions that really helped us to establish how, where, and who we are assisting through that hiring process to be successful. So between those two, it has really helped us to do better as it relates to different, as it relates to associates who have different abilities.
So you guys are actually going out and working with organizations to expand in these areas actively. Rather than coming and applying, you're going out and finding them.
Yes, that is correct.
That's amazing. Wow. You know, it's funny because I've talked to several autistic people. I talked to a guy that's blind, and the same thing over and over I hear is, well, I'm afraid to apply because I don't think that they're going to want me, or you know, I'm afraid to put my application in just for them to find out that I can't see, and then they won't want to, you know, interview me. And they never talk about people going to them. Like they feel like that, you know, because that it's up to them to apply, that they feel like that there's that sense of that nobody cares. When in turn, there's a lot of companies that do care, and even go as far as like you guys, where you're actually going out and seeking those people out, which I think is incredible. I just wish that even larger companies, there's so, you and I both know, there's so many large companies that don't do enough. It's shameful. And you look at the Fortune 100 list, and the I think it's like less than 10% is diverse. And you're like, come on, guys. I mean, this is 2020. What do you think? We're obviously going through a movement. I love it. Who knew that this would be happening the way it's happening? We're going through a movement now where I think the whole mindset behind how we look at people is changing. You know, obviously we're coming into battle with certain political risk constraints, but at the end of the day, I think that people's view on people is changing, you know, exponentially. Many people, you know, now that we're in this time, many people will say, oh, crap. We need to hire 10 diversity people so we can say that we're part of this movement. That's not really the way to do it. Because at the end of the day, just because you hire somebody who's diverse doesn't mean that you're diverse and inclusive friendly, or you have any type of program. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with education. What do you think that you guys, what kind of resources are out there just in general? Because I know you talk about training, and I'm sure you guys don't do all your own training. I'm sure you bring outside resources in as well. What do you guys do as far as further education to really help your people understand that there's more to it than we hire diversity? I mean, I get you guys do. But, you know, for companies that are out there that are thinking, God, how do we start this? Like, you know, how do we even, you know, break the ice and trying to figure out how we're going to become a diversity inclusive company. What kind of resources do you guys use?
There's a whole host. I think the first thing you have to acknowledge is that it's a journey. We've been on this journey since the early 40s as an organization. So it's a journey. But I would also say that as a part of this journey, you have to be very clear on what your goals are in terms of the priorities that you have. So it's very important to have the right vision and the right mission, of course, but equally as important, if not more, the leadership of the organization must not only be bought in, but they must sponsor the change and they must demonstrate the change that they expect of their workforce. So that is extremely important that the leadership, they need to be ready. You know, often we are asked the same question you just asked of me. So what do we go and do first? I think you need to first do an assessment of your current landscape. And then from a leadership perspective, you need to ask yourself some really tough questions that end with, are we ready? And then when I say the we, that is the collective senior leadership who make up this organization. And there'll be some individuals who are not and some who are. Then you have to make some really tough decisions to determine, you know, what matters most to you to move forward. But you absolutely need buy-in at your senior most leadership level. I think the second thing that you need to think about is what is going to be the priority for today, tomorrow, and into the future, realizing that you can boil an ocean with many of the opportunities and gaps that you identify in your company, and that it's very important to be very intentional about what you go after first and your why. So every company's why could be very different, but understand what is your true north, what is your why. The third thing I would say is that you need to solicit help. There are a lot of diversity, equity, engagement, inclusion professionals who do this type of work every day. Leverage your resources. Don't assume that you can simply put individuals in role because they look like where you want to be. And don't assume that every individual who looks like what you would like to be is actually equipped and prepared to do that type of work. I think that is a huge misstep that companies can make. And then the second area that I would say companies make in terms of a misstep and how to improve their outcome is being really realistic about what they hope to accomplish in the process. The third thing you need to do is really take stock of how you want to embark on this transformation, but it should ultimately lead to a shift in the culture internally as well as externally. And I say that because many organizations, particularly in this climate, have great external reputation, but the internal culture is dying. And as a result, they are not getting the outcome that they desire because they have not internally addressed the culture, but they are extremely masterful at presenting a great external face.
So I want to ask one last question, and it's a tricky question.
Okay.
and we can always add it out if you don't like it. No, I'm just kidding. I had a person on my show, an African-American woman, who expressed deeply that she felt that to have a D&I program, you have to have someone of color at the top. I disagreed. I don't believe that that's really fair. I think that anybody of a diverse background, you know, in theory, I guess you could say white people, but I'm not really sure. Well, a white male, I guess that argument could be there. But I don't think that a diversity and inclusion program should be, you know, hyper-focused on one particular race or culture or person. However, surprisingly, I got pushback from people agreeing with her that because of just the culture that it's there's more power to having somebody of color at the top of a D&I program. And I'm putting you on the spot, I know, but I'm not gonna ask you the one question. I'm gonna ask you a different one. Do you feel like that if you put a gay person or you put a transgender person or you put someone who's disabled at the top of a D&I program, do you feel like that they can garner as much respect and have the ability to really empower the group as much as someone of color? I get the point. I think the big argument that, you know, it's funny because I talked to, you're going to love this one. I talked to a Fortune 100 company. I talked to the second in command of a D&I program at a Fortune 100 company, who's a white male. Mm-hmm. The company is extraordinarily well known to be a white men's company, you know? Mm-hmm. So they've been holding on to this notion that they've been holding on to this stigma for years. Many people will probably figure it out just as I'm talking about it. So they put a white male as second in command of this D&I program. And I thought it was peculiar. So I called him up because I wanted to get his insight of why. And it was interesting because the African-American D&I leader put him as the second in command because she said that why does diversity have to mean anybody particular? Why can't a white male be diverse? And I thought that was very unusual. Again, not 100% sure I agree, but I guess it goes back to the initial question. Do you think that right now, because of the landscape, because of, you know, the fact that, you know, I could truly say that people of color really have not gotten, you know, a fair shake at things. And I, as a white male, but gay, I can say that for confident that I just don't think that it's right. And I don't think it's happened. Do you think that it's almost where we have to have somebody of color at the top? Or do you feel like that there shouldn't be that stigma of putting a person of color, because then it gets down to, are we doing this for more of a tokenistic way, more so than a this is what's right way? Does that make sense?
It does. So I don't believe the answer is singular. I think that it's all contingent on the work that's going to be done. So do I think only a person of color or visibly diverse person can be the chief diversity officer? Is that the question?
Yes, good. That's exactly the question.
I would say in most environments today, it is an advantage because in all other areas in many organizations, you do not have an ethnically or visibly diverse leader in role. I would say what's most important is having multiple voices of leadership at the table. And in most instances, unfortunately, the predominant and dominant voice today in leadership at the most senior level is a white male. So to add an additional white male, it could be perceived that we have not done anything differently and we do not have that different voice at the table. I do think it could be unfair because I know nothing about that person's voice. What's to say that person did not grow up in a very diverse environment or in under circumstances that would have that individual's experience be much more synonymous with that of a ethnically or visibly diverse person? I don't know. I think that's where it really comes down to what is the person's identity and makeup before I can make the statement that any person who is ethnically or visibly diverse is more suited for a role, because that would be the same biased methodology that is used today to describe who is most likely and best suited for a CEO position, which would be a tall, cisgender, white male above 6 feet tall. I mean, that's, but if you look at the profile of what we have, you'll continue to do what you have because you believe it's a formula that works.
Right.
So I firmly believe you need a person who is able to be very comfortable in communicating, which may often be a dissenting opinion and may need to be very specific about experiences or instances that may not be or could be their truth or something that they have capability of speaking to. It's hard for me to just give one quick answer because I think it all depends. I don't think it's fair to discount, but I would certainly say, given the current landscape, I could see why a person would say, look, this is necessary because often we can't be what we can't see, anyone who's ethnically or visibly diverse. So if we are going to have in role someone who appears to be of the majority, what confidence do I feel like, and how can I presume their level of ability to provide that voice at the table if at least visibly it doesn't appear that we have shared experience?
Yeah, you know, it's a very, I love your answer, by the way. The reason I like your answer is because the one thing you honed in on, which I was an argument that I've heard before, is that it really depends on what the person's background is and where they came from. Because
experience.
Right. I mean, you know, where that it speaks a lot to the person's personal experiences to know whether or not that they're going to be able to really lead that organization. For instance, correct. You know, we know that there are wealthy people of color out there that grew up in very wealthy areas and wealthy neighborhoods, and maybe they weren't subjected to or weren't put into environments where there was a lot of diversity. Doesn't make them bad, but could they speak to that level of diversity that we're looking for in a D&I organization? I think the challenge next for us is something that you said that oftentimes I say myself is, you know, it's easy to identify someone that you can physically see as diverse.
Correct.
It's very difficult to identify someone who is not physically, who can't physically see they're diverse. And how do we get to a point where my biggest thing that frustrates me is the fact that we've gotten to a point now where it's all about what we see. Well, I personally don't understand why we're even judging people by what we see, but the thought process that there are also people that you can't physically see their disability, but we know that they are treated unfairly as well because of the things that they lack or because of the way they act or because of their mannerisms, you know, how do we bridge that so that people understand that it's not just a physical thing? That sometimes you have to look beyond what you see and understand that there are people out there that you may think are part of the masses, but in all retrospect, they're also one of those people that, you know, are treated differently because of who they are.
It goes to the question of, is it a difference that makes a difference? And that's where you have to have conversation. That's where you have to have understanding and clarity on what it is that you want the individual to bring to the table. So that's why I think it's a higher probability that people feel if someone who is ethnically or visibly diverse is at the table, there is a higher probability that they will be able to communicate, bring up, speak on behalf of, understand, empathize differently than those who are not. But again, each person is very different, right? And everyone comes from different backgrounds that shape who you are. I think that's where it's important to understand someone's qualifications and ability, right? Because even if you are qualified, but you are not able to establish your, not only the seat at the table, but how you use that seat at the table, whether you are ethnically or visibly diverse or not, if you don't use your seat in a way that's effective, it doesn't matter what you look like. Because the real real rubber hits the road is how effective are you with that group of leaders that you work with to drive change and to be a visible leader who can provide value in that space.
I love this conversation. Is awesome. The whole way you guys do things, the onboarding, just it's people should really take notes from this, because I think that you're right. If we address the elephant in the room right at the beginning of the process and make sure that everybody's on board with the company's strategy and the plan, it makes it so much easier than trying to try to tackle things as they get thrown in. And it happens every day where we have these events that happen where people are put in situations and they're not trained to how to handle it or even what to do. So listen, Monique, I really appreciate you coming on. I know it's late. I know you work a lot, as I do too. I really appreciate you taking the time, because it's a voice that I wanted heard. I want people to understand there's all kinds of great ways that you can create a diversity, inclusive culture. And it just really brings a lot of new ideas to the table that I think people would want to hear and help them with their journey as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate the time, and it's important. It's a topic that's very near and dear to me, because I recognize that if we don't have courageous dialogue and conversation and discussion, which is, you know, there's no end, it's more of a conversation and discussion, we won't be able to advance forward as a collective. And that should be the ultimate goal, which is how do we advance forward? Because look, the growth is messy, but it's necessary.
You said, I want to leave it on one note. You said one thing that I want to highlight, and that is it always starts from the top.
It does.
I want all my listeners to let that sit in. It always starts from the top, whether it be within a company or whether it be politically. In order to have a diverse and inclusive culture, it starts from the top. And that's what we need. We need somebody who's going to lead in times where, you know, it's necessary, so that we can see the success of diversity and inclusion. So thank you. A terrible plug, but you know, I had to do it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It was such a pleasure. We've known each other for 15 years. I'm so glad that you are participating in this with me. And I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of the week.
Great. Thank you for having me.
No problem. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Please remember to subscribe to my podcast. Also, please feel free to share, like, send, tag your friends, let them have the opportunity to listen and understand and get a better viewpoint from the people that we talk to. Also, please don't forget, if you have any questions, you can email me at any time. And I hope you guys had a great day.